Welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and for the purposes of this intro, I am joined by Mr. David Holmes and producer Miles. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Ollie.
How are we both doing?
Yeah, not so bad. Not so bad. Friday afternoon, isn't it?
Yeah, could always be worse. Good session today, wasn't it? I know we always say that, but yeah, it was a lot of fun, wasn't it, Dave?
It was. It's we keep kind of going back to cookies, don't we? And it's there's certainly some really interesting interactions around the cookies and some topical areas around the cookies, wasn't there? So it's interesting in that sense to see where that might go, especially in like with the current government kind of direction on that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sometimes slightly frustrating, perhaps, that we do end up talking about cookies and the government's data reform bill quite so much and on quite such a regular basis. But there's so much to talk about. You know, it's difficult to avoid the topics. They're pretty omnipresent and they're really interesting. There's a lot to cover. So just to sort of clarify, the things we spoke about today specifically were... We spoke a little bit about the ICO's new agreement on their funding and the fact that they can keep some of the funds they recover from their enforcement action. We then went on to speak about, we continued again on the government's data reform bill. We spoke a lot about the value of fines versus other types of enforcement, which I thought was really interesting, Dave. There was a lot of interesting perspectives from regular listeners on that, which I very much appreciated, particularly really the public sector. I thought that was good.
No, for sure. And I've anybody who regularly listens will know that I'm an advocate for additional enforcement measures and not necessarily just fines. So it's certainly another positive potential direction under John's direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So we spoke about that for a certain period. Then we had a couple bits of enforcement action from further afield, particularly regarding Google Analytics. And we spoke about international transfers, but then that led us sort of naturally down the path of analytics and tracking technologies and cookies, which, as you may know, if you're a regular listener, we end up talking about quite a lot on this podcast. But it's interesting. There's a lot to talk about. What we're supposed to do is what it is, isn't it? If, you know, there's so much to talk about, you can't really get away from it.
Well, yeah, no, we didn't cover everything, but I think what was interesting was that we were actually quite responsive to the chat in the session, and we could have potentially moved on from the cookies, but because there's a lot of chat and a lot of interaction, we've saved some of the other bits till the end of the week.
That is also true. And if you are listening to this back as a podcast listener and you are curious to get in on the chat, so to speak, if you would like to contribute, if you'd like to be a part of that, then why not come along to the live sessions every Friday from 12:30. Dave and I have a chat for about an hour, and yeah, you can get involved live with any of the chat elements that we've discussed, or hop onto the session directly and have a chat to us. You can reach out through any of the normal channels to us for an invite to those sessions, or directly on the DPP website events page. There's a link to sign up there. So yeah, good session. A lot to talk about. A lot of good interaction, as you say, Dave. Also, as we mentioned, this is one of our GDPR radio episodes, so every other week. Next week, we're back with a themed session, therefore, and I'm quite looking forward to this one. We're going to be speaking to our friends over at 3C Consulting, and we're going to be talking to them about, I suppose it's sort of data accuracy, but really a lot of it is about maximizing the value of your data and really, you know, achieving excellence, I think, is the title of the session. Excellence.
Possibly so, but you won't be able to achieve data excellence if your accuracy, integrity, the data wasn't there. So it is intertwined. Yeah. So you've got that nice link there with. And I've not seen that done particularly well. So I'm interested in listening to see what 3C have to say about organisations and how they can improve accuracy, integrity of the data in order to have that value and to be able to drive additional insights.
Yeah, and they have a slightly different view on it to us, as you know, obviously we're compliance people, but them less so. So I think it's going to be interesting to really see some different perspectives and kick that around a bit. So I'm really looking forward to that. Do join us for that next week. That should be excellent. I think that's all really that we've got on the cards at the minute. Obviously, there's plenty of events to come. I think we're just finalising, Producer Miles, our events calendar for the next 3 months, if that's not already done. In fact, I know it's already done. You pushed it live yesterday, didn't you?
It is. It's live on LinkedIn now. So if you are listening on Spotify, you can find us on LinkedIn at Data Protection People. And it's one of the most recent posts on there. We've got events leading all the way up till the 12th of August. So quite a lineup.
So go and check that out. There's plenty on there to get stuck into. And there's always something for everyone, as we say. You know, there's plenty to talk about in this space. So you'll find something that takes your fancy, I am sure. Without further ado, we've already rabbited on sufficiently, Dave. I don't think there's anything else for us to cover.
I think that's it for now.
That's it for now. So on that note, we will let you get stuck into this podcast and we will see you all very soon. Without further ado, let's get into a little bit of what's been in the news. So I can see, as I mentioned off air, that you're furiously typing away notes in our session plan here. So I'll let you finish those up while I talk about a couple of bits that I'd seen. Now, I can't remember, and you'll all have to forgive me if we've already covered this, but I don't think we necessarily spoke about it at length when it first came out. So obviously, a couple of weeks ago, we spent a lot of time talking about the government's response to the consultation on the data reform bill that I think we've covered extensively. I'm not sure there's anything more to be said. However, Dave, if you've had any thoughts since then, you know, now that you've slept on it, then obviously feel free to launch them in. But I think we covered that pretty thoroughly.
Shall we just calm down a little bit?
that's what we like to hear. But yeah, I think we covered that pretty, you know, comprehensively a couple of weeks ago. And there was one thing, however, which was not a part of that response but was announced around the same time, and I can't remember if we did mention it, but I thought it was worth spending a little bit more time on if we hadn't, which is an announcement which was made around the same time, so it got lost a little bit, I think, in terms of the PR and the communications around it, that the ICO struck an agreement with the Treasury, I think it was, but effectively struck an agreement to start retaining a certain amount of the fines which they recover as part of their enforcement action. Now,
yes.
Some of you may know, I wrote a very short blog about this week that's up on our socials and on the DPP website, but I thought it was interesting for a number of reasons. So the first thing to point out is that it's not something I'd necessarily looked at too much until I wrote this short piece, which is, you know, how is the ICO actually funded? I was aware, broadly speaking, of its mechanisms, but to sort of, you know, cut a potentially quite long story short, the ICO is basically funded through two streams of revenue, right, Dave? It's funded through the data protection fee, so the fee that all organizations have to pay to register as an organization. I think most of us who are in charge of that will be aware of that. And it's also partly funded through government funding directly through grants, right? Grants in aid specifically. Now, basically my premise in all of this was that it's interesting that a new revenue stream has been opened up, full stop, because I think a number of the European regulators already do this, unless I'm mistaken. And effectively,
I think they're doing part. I'm not sure if they do it wholly, but I know they're doing some part with what you're referring to.
Yeah. And effectively, this latest update would allow the ICO to retain up to £7.5 million of the money they recover from their enforcement action in any given year. Now, I thought this was significant, particularly when we're looking at, you know, the broader context of the data protection reform bill. We're considering potentially the independence of the regulator, because there were things in there about its governance model around how potentially the commission themselves might be appointed, things like that. So there were issues maybe about the independence of the regulator, weren't there, in that reform bill, Dave? So I think it's interesting to take a look at the funding model at this time. And is that something which fundamentally empowers them further? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I think from my perspective, and again, well, Miles has popped the link there in the chat, from my perspective, I think it can only really be a good thing, because ultimately the inference is that the ICO here, first of all, is going to be better funded, full stop, because I think I ran some numbers on it and it sort of works out as a give or take 17-18% rise in their revenue overall, or in their funding rather than their revenue, sorry. And I do think that if the side effect of this is that they're going to be handing out fines more aggressively, or handing out bigger fines, I know, and I'm sure there's someone here that will disagree with me, I know that fines aren't necessarily the best way to drive compliance. That's not what I'm saying, but we've spent a long time, or some of us have spent a long time anyway, talking to boards and exec teams up and down the country, trying to convince them that the ICO is a real problem, that it's a threat, that you have to take data protection compliance seriously. And I do think that there is still a value in a big hefty fine in that respect. So I think incentivizing that can only be positive. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, Dave. We've not actually spoken about it because we've been away, but
I think it's a good thing. I think it's a positive thing that they can. I know there's, you may think, well, it incentivizes it. It may encourage them to find more, or it may encourage them to withstand challenges to the fines, because there's an element that they're going to retain something out of that. But conversely, if they're, because at the moment they're meant to be independent of the government, but they're still kind of slightly funded by the government in that sense. And it would, I'm not saying I'm right in this sense, but it would give the impression that they are more independent, because the funding streams aren't governed through either paying the fee or government grants.
Yes.
In that sense. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's only positive that they can. I'd certainly like to see that that was backed up by, and it would lead into what we're going to come on talking about with some of the developments with the ISO, where they flex the muscles a little bit more in the other powers that they've got, not necessarily straight down the fines, because I'm an advocate of the fact that I don't necessarily think fines are appropriate to fully encourage compliance when you've got a range of other measures available to you in that sense. We'll come on to that point. So I think
come
it's
on to
a positive
that in a second
thing.
But I mean, I think Alan's basically echoing our point where he says you know, we know it's not usually considered a good thing for regulators to keep the dosh from their fines, but it is hard to get excited about chasing recoveries, etc., when you know the proceeds will go to the treasury, i.e. referring to internally. Obviously, it incentivizes them. I mean, there's also an argument to say that arguably, if they're, as you say, David, they're funded by the Treasury anyway, is it such a problem that they're going to be retaining the money directly? I'm not entirely sure. I do think also there's a broader point, possibly. I mean, I looked at it, and these were very crude numbers. Around anyone who knows me privately knows that I simply cannot do maths. I'm absolutely terrible with numbers, but I did try and take a look at it. And as far as I was aware, as far as I could make out, the ICO have never recovered £7.5 million worth of fines in a year. I'm not entirely convinced that they've ever recovered, well, that they've not recovered that amount since 2018 even, because I looked at it, and overall, because there are a number which obviously are appealed, even though, you know, you have the BA fines, the merit fines, a number of them are appealed, and a number of them have payment plans agreed. So taking into account purely those that have actually been paid, I was fairly certain that looking at it, that amount hasn't been recovered since 2018, let alone in a single year. So listen, again, as you say, Dave, not necessarily the right way to drive compliance, but it is a way. And I think it probably is positive. One thing, so you mentioned something there, which I wanted to talk about a little bit more, which is, I think it's only come out in the last couple of days, which is, the ICO is setting out a new strategy regarding the public sector, right?
Yes.
I think that's what you were alluding to.
It was.
And long story short, the upshot of it is that they want to focus more on the wider powers available to them with the public sector, as opposed to relying on fines.
Yeah, so you've got your warnings and your reprimands and notices and all that kind of stuff.
And they want to push fines to the back of the queue in terms of an enforcement mechanism for the public sector. Now, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. I've seen a lot of chatter about it on the socials. I've seen a lot of people sort of broadly agreeing with it. You know, there have been arguments made that arguably, if you're finding the public sector. It's all just money from the public purse, which is moving between two different locations, and therefore it's kind of a redundant exercise. There's also an argument to say that you still need a little bit of, you still need your regulator to have bite, because there are still, you know, high ups in some of those public sector organisations that don't take these things seriously. So I don't know what your view is.
I think the bite is still there, because they've not removed the ability to fine public sector. They just said they're going to focus on some of the other areas. So it's not the fact that the fines have gone. They can still fine them if there's really serious contraventions and bits and pieces going on. But I actually think it's another. I know prior to taking some leave, we're kind of saying, oh, it's the third week in a row we've agreed with John Edwards. And I think this is another one where I'd actually tend to agree with him. Because public authorities aren't commercially set up in that sense. And we know at the moment a lot of commercial authorities and things are financially strapped because of the way they're funded through central government and bits and pieces. So finding them, and it comes back to my point about fines not necessarily driving compliance. Fines won't necessarily drive compliance. Fines is a big hit. That means you're not necessarily going to address stuff. You just wear the fine and crack on as normal in that kind of sense. Whereas if you actually say, no, there's an enforcement action, we disagree with the approach that you're going to take. You're not going to get fined, but we disagree with it. And if they say you've got an enforcement action that we need to see actioned within a determined period of time, so let's say you've got 6 months to address this point and show evidence that you've been addressing that point, then that may still come at a cost to the public authority, on depending what they may need to invest in, whether it's time, people, resources, that kind of thing. So it will still have an impact, and it could still have quite a big impact on the organisation, but it's just not necessarily beating with a stick. It's kind of saying you've got to do this, and you've got to do it by this point in time. Otherwise, we'll take it seriously. So I think it can only be a good thing in that sense with some of the public authorities. I do get some of the arguments, like I say, about it's just moving taxes around and all the rest of it. But unfortunately, if it's like local authorities, local councils, they're not fully funded through central government. They're funded, some of them are funded, as you know, through council taxes and stuff. So who's going to be the individuals that are affected by it most? And it could well be the local residents through increases in personal taxes and things. So. I think the fact that the more inclined to use their other enforcement measures is only a good thing, and I would like to see that rolled out a little bit more, to be fair.
Well, yeah, one of your biggest gripes historically is that the regulator's too lenient in terms of investigating allegations, right? Or at least in sort of mopping up after breaches. Yeah, the fact that all too rarely the party at fault is asked to actually produce evidence or follow up.
For sure. And I've been involved with breaches where you demonstrated an action plan, and they kind of went, yeah, fair enough, we'll accept that. And that's not even followed up with, well, we accept your action plan. Can you demonstrate it's been completed by? You know what I mean? In that sense. So I would like to see a little bit more kind of enforcement or drive towards changing culture and drive towards compliance through using some of the other mechanisms, not necessarily just fines. And I think this can only be a positive thing.
For sure. Sorry if I lost my trail of thought there slightly. I got a little bit distracted. I've been reading in the chat Lawrence's points, because I think they're bang on, effectively, and we've said this a lot of the time. So we're talking a lot about fines here, but I think only really in the context that they're sort of on the menu, so to speak, with the ICO's latest announcements. But Lawrence makes the point that ultimately, I'm gonna unfortunately boil your argument down, Lawrence, and I'm sorry if I'm undercutting any point of it, but effectively that while fines are all well and good, there can be a sense that if a fine is handed down, that's done and dusted, you can pay it, you can deal with it, whatever. But actually, there's a huge amount of value in a public reprimand, whether, you know, that's under any of the powers that the ICO have available to them, which sort of would meet that objective of publicly naming and shaming an organisation and their practices. Because that ultimately opens the door to a number of actions from the public. You know, a lot of claims for damages, claims for breaches, all sorts. It also damages the confidence and the public perception of those organisations, or the confidence of the public in those organisations.
And it is likely, just on that point, it is likely to increase the number of subject access requests you'll get, because people will want to understand what you've got on them and whether it's potentially been compromised and so on.
That's also very true. That's also very true. And yeah, ultimately, you know, in a day and age where the shift is happening to a space where businesses are more in need of having that trust from data subjects, I think that there has been a phase where that's sort of gone out the window a little bit, but I do think it's probably coming back around. It's incredibly important to have that. And ultimately, you know, if you lose that through basically, as I say, being named and shamed. I mean, you only had to see the whole business around, was it WhatsApp a while ago when they changed their privacy notice and people in their droves sort of fled to Telegram as an alternative. You know, I mean, I don't know what the actual impact of that on their business is, whether, you know, their share price takes a tumble or anything like that, but it's very easily done. And the thing is, in with these types of organizations, the trust from the public is incredibly hard to repair once it's damaged, I think. Well, I don't know that for a fact. I've seen it
with breaches of some of our clients, where you have a service breach, you've lost the trust, you've had individuals being really kind of cautious about what information they share. And if you're in a particular sector, let's say social housing, where you may have to do tenancy audits and go and gather information, or at least visit people and ask them questions about how the tenancy is going and that kind of thing, it can be awfully difficult to get the trust back for them to give you any further information as part of your normal ongoing approach, regulatory or otherwise, in that sense. And I've seen the effects where individuals are finding it very difficult to do the job because people just don't trust them because you've had a data breach. So.
Yeah, and ultimately that's always going to have a knock-on effect. So I think we can sort of draw a line on that by saying that we completely agree with Lawrence's point, and I hope I've not sort of done that a disservice. Obviously, it's all in the chat for those who are with us live. You can take a read through yourselves. But there's another point here that's quite interesting, which Alan makes, and again, we've not mentioned, which is that the ISO also has another big stick they rarely use, in that they can require controllers to suspend processing for particularly heinous breaches, especially if the controller isn't interested in fixing things. And that's a very good point. That's something which is, I don't think has ever been used, maybe. I don't know if someone can correct me on that. But it's certainly not used regularly, that's for sure. And arguably, in terms of business impact, that could be beyond significant. It'd be absolutely huge if the ICO says, yeah, you know, you need to stop whatever it is you're doing. I think maybe they do it, I don't know whether that's the same power they use under PECA when they sort of ask people to stop doing what they're doing or not. Maybe getting confused there, but you know, feasibly it's an incredibly powerful tool they have there, which,
well, for sure. Can you imagine being an organisation that's being stopped by the regulator from processing for a period of time? Just the sheer impact of that, which is what the point I was getting to. And it really depends on how the ICO implements enforcement measures and what those measures are, whether they're going to have an impact. So that's the bit that kind of gets watered down a little bit for me. But as long as the enforcement is robust enough and enforced enough and that kind of thing, then the other powers that the ICO has got can be more damaging to an organisation than necessarily just a straight fine in that sense.
For sure. And just to finish on this point, I think maybe, or at least on a previous one we've made, Dave's comment's very interesting. And again, just another aspect of this, which, because it's such a complex beast, right? When you're talking about the knock-on effects of enforcement action, when you're talking about funding, all these issues, incredibly complex ecosystems that you're dealing with. And again, Dave makes a very good point, which is that one of those effects for the public sector in particular can be the accessibility of funding for the IG manager or information governance professional or whoever it is within the organization. If you're struggling for funding as a result of you know, the damaging effects that any of this could have on you, all of a sudden that's, you know, it's a very different ball game you're playing all of a sudden. And that's just going to sort of open a real, what's the word I'm looking for? It's going to open a real vicious circle where you're going to struggle to implement proper corrective action, I'd have thought. So again, it's just an interesting angle on the broader issue. I don't know if you had anything else on this, Dave, but
it's something which
we'll struggle to cover off in its entirety.
For sure. And I think that there may well be somewhere along the line, as it kind of comes through, there may well be the law of unintended consequences going on. We'd have to just wait and see what that happens when that comes out, so we can kind of discuss it further. But on the overall, I'm quite positive about it. It's what I've been. One of the issues I know we've talked about quite a while, which is the regulator enforcing more, but not necessarily through fines. So to me, it feels like a good thing. And I think it's just a case of we just need to watch and see how that might transit out as a consequence of that. So I just hope it's flexing the ICR and the regulator being able to flex the powers that they have and how they do that in order to drive compliance forward. In that sense, I do wonder, however, and this is only rather slightly cynical just on this final point, whether they are relaxing their approach slightly because of what they're trying to achieve with the data reforms and possible public authorities and further use of data, and whether they're trying to assist organisations to feel more confident in supporting the data reform bill and what they can do with information moving forward if the reforms get passed.
Quite possibly. I hadn't thought about it like that, to be perfectly honest.
Just the old cynic in me. Sorry, it just had to come out.
No, that's quite all right. Don't you worry. Yeah, I think that's probably as much as I'm able to say on the subject at this moment. I'm not sure there's necessarily a clear cut, you know, the list of pros and cons of in respect of this. I think also what I would like to get across is that we're not necessarily saying that we have a preference for fines over any type of enforcement action. In fact, Dave specifically, I think probably you'd have the opposite view, generally speaking. But I do think that if you are bolstering fines, that's probably a good thing. If you are more broadly bolstering enforcement action, I think I can understand that if you are bolstering enforcement action, in bolstering fines, at the cost of reducing other types of enforcement, then that is problematic. And I do appreciate that. So
it'd be interesting, yeah, just the final point. It would be interesting to see what might happen moving forward with how, let's say, the ICO take it forward on that. Because if you kind of say, well, organisations are only really fined for really serious contraventions, and usually it's for ignoring stuff with the ICO, and whether any of that will actually be addressed through if they're looking at taking other enforcement measures, because sometimes if you've got a good enough story to tell, the ICO will kind of look at it and kind of go, well, we get your argument, we get the justification for it, you maybe need to think in these areas. And I just wonder whether some of the enforcement measures other than fines maybe exercise more in the area where it's, well, we can understand your judgment, but you've now only got 4 weeks to sort this out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, which would be the correct approach. I mean, they've always tried, I think, to maintain that sort of critical friend almost type of relationship with a lot of organizations. And I think generally their approach has always been, you know, we're not going to bury you unless we feel it's appropriate. We're always going to try and help you in the first instance. We're going to get really ticked off if you, you know, intentionally ignore us or you don't listen to what we're trying to tell you.
So
if you're trying to support that approach by saying, look, we're going to invest far more significantly in, you know, our investigative functions in that respect, and we're going to invest really heavily in, you know, looking into these alleged breaches or, you know, whatever it might be, and then helping organizations correct those issues as opposed to looking to bury them, whether it's through, as we've said, fines, reprimands, whether it's through, you know, requiring them to stop certain operations, whatever it is. You know, we've not even spoken about one of our favorite sort of subtopics to all this, which is directors' liability. That's an entirely different issue. But regardless of that, if they're able to at least really reinforce their ability to help organizations through this, then that's most likely a good thing, I'd have thought. I don't see how it can be a bad thing. You've got on our session plan here, Dave, a number of instances of enforcement action, you know, funnily enough. One of the things that you seem to have highlighted first of all is from our European friends, from the Italian regulator, about Google Analytics. Do you want to talk a little bit about that for a second?
Yeah, it kind of, in essence, it's not a big story. And for anybody who's kind of been following issues of Google Analytics, it's just another decision that kind of is aligned with the French and the Austrian regulators in that sense. And this is where the Italian data protection authorities kind of effectively banned the use of Google Analytics and similar technologies because of the in essence, the data transfer from Italy to the USA, and they stated that the Google Analytics data cannot be adequately protected, so even a truncated IP address would not qualify as anonymized, given Google's ability to identify it, and therefore they've basically banned it and issued a 90-day compliance deadline to make sure that you you understand the ruling and you align yourself with the outcome of that. And that just got me thinking, really, because, you know, you've got three regulators, you've got the French, the Austrian and the Italians kind of going that way with Google Analytics. And I know it's not law at the moment, it's only the government's response to the reform bill, but the UK was kind of detracting slightly from that, wasn't it, with the Google, with the analytics side of things, sorry, and cookies, not necessarily Google Analytics, but just with general cookies and that kind of thing. It just made me wonder, where does this leave the UK following the proposed reforms, or the government's response to the proposed reforms, and what might be coming down the line with regulatory changes?
Yeah, and I feel like in this context, I might have made this up, but I'm sure I saw just today that the ICO is setting out their new approach to future BCR decisions. Or have I made that up?
I've not read that yet. I have seen that, but it's not actually read the article yet.
So again, part of this, you know, complex beast where we've spoken about it for a long time, haven't we? Post-Brexit, this idea that we are going to likely see increasing divergence from what the Europeans are doing, but where does that put us with our own adequacy rulings? And in this context, you know, it's incredibly difficult. The Google Analytics thing, I think, is really interesting. I believe that they are working on it over at Google at the minute to try and get something out which allows their European customer base, or their European users rather, to keep using the solution despite these, you know, decisions from the European regulators. But as far as we're aware, at the minute, the only way to use it compliantly is the way that the CNIL have described, which I think I maybe mentioned a couple of weeks ago, which, again, as you kind of alluded to, Dave, is all about stripping out data before it gets an IP address, specifically before they get shipped over the Atlantic, because that's kind of the core of the issue, right? But it's going to be fascinating to see how this continues to develop and whether, because it could be a real sort of tipping point for the UK in terms of our direction going forwards. Is this the sort of thing that we are going to side with our European counterparts on, or is it something which we're not going to kick up too much of a fuss about and thereby potentially jeopardize our situation with said European counterparts? I don't know. As you mentioned, it's interesting to see in the data reform bill that elements around cookie consent are looking to be dialed back, which would potentially suggest that we're taking a more lax view on it.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. Sure. I mean, ultimately, again, as we've mentioned previously, you'd think that if the Europeans are setting the standard on this, and most of the world is moving towards that same standard, as we have seen, you know, a number of jurisdictions around the world are moving increasingly towards what is effectively a GDPR, or at least European standard on these matters, it does seem rather baffling to start moving backwards effectively and shying away from that. Doesn't make a huge amount of sense, but...
No, and it's, yeah, and that's really interesting. Like I said, the government's consultation to reform bill is just their response. It doesn't necessarily mean it's made its way into a bill yet, and it's certainly not been through the legislative process. So if anybody's reading the government's response to the consultation process, I wouldn't start acting at this moment in time, getting rid of your DPOs and deciding to tear up your ROPAs and things like this. At this present moment in time, it's still got a long way to go through the legislative process in that sense. But it gives you a direction of travel, and it's that direction of travel that's interesting in the areas that we're really kind of talking about at the moment in relation to the European stance on Google Analytics and that kind of thing, and the divergence or potential for divergence with the government's consultation and data reform. But what was a bit more interesting to on that as well really relates to an additional point that I'm that I kind of wanted to cover off as well. So it's not just in relation to the Italian saying, well, you can't use Google Analytics because of the data transfers to the US. But I've read an article, I don't know if anybody else has come across it, that relates to whether the EU is planning on introducing data localization requirements for cloud services. And there's a draft data security certification scheme for cloud services, which contains data localization and sovereignty requirements, which could impact cloud service providers in the EU market, ensures kind of primacy of the EU law and requires maintenance data and operations to be headquartered in the EU. So it was interesting kind of reading those together. I read the bit about the Italians first, and they kind of following suit on Google Analytics, and kind of shortly after that read this potential that there might be this localization for cloud services coming in.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it was one of the things that we pointed out when a lot of the TREM stuff first went through is, you know, were we going to see a huge amount of regionalization for this type of thing? And, you know, a lot of movement in that direction. I think we have seen a lot of that happen. I think there has been increased focus on, you know, where are your servers? We've made efforts to, you know, segment all of our European customer data to a database in Germany or whatever it is. I think we do see a lot of that, but arguably, again, that fits within this broader movement. And I'm not necessarily sure it would be such a bad thing. I mean, to be honest with you, I hadn't heard of it until you put it in my notes, so I'm coming to it really cold. I don't really know a huge amount about it, but I don't see in what way it would necessarily be counterproductive.
But it'd be also interesting whether if the cloud service providers have got to be headquartered in the EU, in that sense, and by nowhere controlled by non-EU entities, whether that's an effort, to get around the potential extraterritoriality of FISA that we've often discussed with the American laws, and whether kind of saying it's ours, it's in Europe, you've got to be based here, whether that's trying to circumvent some of that actions.
Well, that's a good point, because despite what I've just said, I do still spend a lot of time arguing with customers and their suppliers alike that, you know, even if it's AWS, even if it's hosted in Ireland, it's still Amazon, it's still an American company. Like, the whole Schrems thing still applies. It doesn't go out the window just because you've moved your servers to the Republic of Ireland or to Germany or wherever. If you are a US company, you are a US company, and that's kind of end of. It's deemed to be a transfer to America, or at least capable of being a transfer to America in that sense. So there's still, I think, a lack of clarity on that, maybe.
For sure. But at this stage, it's only planning. And again, sure, it's potential direction of travel, because it's only planning. Doesn't necessarily all make its way through the due process. But it was interesting to read anyway, even if it's not going to go anywhere. It's interesting as a concept and interesting as a potential direction of travel there.
No, for sure. And again, it forms part of this broader conversation that we have about the whole international transfers issue, which you feel is going to have to come to some sort of head soon enough, because I think a lot of it is not massively sustainable. I've spoken about my frustrations in the past at what we sort of have to go through at the minute with the UK and transfer risk assessments and all that sort of stuff, and the fact that you're dealing with different sets of standard contractual clauses or all this business. Obviously, that's primarily a side effect of Brexit rather than anything else, but still, it's part of the conversation. It's part of the broader landscape of international transfers and just how difficult it can be in this day and age. And, my advice to a lot of customers still hasn't changed, which is that if you can find a European or UK supplier to use over an American one, then I would rather you do that, just because it saves us all a lot of paperwork, quite frankly, which shouldn't be the main criteria, should it? But
no,
that's where we are with things. That's where we are.
And just whilst we're on the topic of cookies, tracking technology, Google Analytics and stuff, it might be worth possibly just looking at a news feed actually that's I've only recently picked up on, although it was published on the 22nd of June this year, so you may have possibly come across it. And it claims that hospital patient data is secretly sent to Facebook, which has been alleged in a lawsuit, and only from our friends across the other side of the pond. But it says a tracking tool on hospital websites sent private data such as appointment prescriptions to Facebook. So this lawsuit claims. I don't know if you ever, have you come across that?
Yes, I had noticed this, but I'll be honest, I didn't read much the headline. Yeah. So if you have, happy to hear more about it.
So it says, I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. So it says the Facebook has been receiving private medical data thanks to the tracking tool Metapixel, which is installed on many hospital websites, according to a report published on the 16th of June by The Markup. It says the next day, a class action lawsuit was filed against Facebook parent, alleging that the company had violated health privacy rules, which is interesting because it's the patient who filed the case is in the Northern District of California. And anybody who understands US laws may well be aware of the health information is protected by the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, so HIPAA. So it's interesting, as like I said, I've just come across it, but it's all obviously if it's in relation to Facebook's Pixel tracking tool or something along those kind of senses. It is in line with cookies because it's similar technology, isn't it? So I just thought it was quite interesting since we're in that kind of area at the moment, just to raise that and see if anybody had come across it, if anybody's got any comments and thoughts on it. And the article actually continues to say that it's an extreme example of how far the tentacles of big tech reach into what we think of as a protected data space. So it's quite an interesting article and potentially another one to watch in that sense. But it's I just thought it was interesting.
Pixels are notoriously a funny one. A lot of that technology, again, we know, all of us here, that sort of thing is tracking technology for e-privacy directive purposes and therefore requires consent.
For sure.
But I'm not sure how well that's understood, or at least it's certainly not applied well across a number of tech firms. Because,
no, for sure. It's only an article and it's only alleged, so some of the digging might have to ascertain the exact details. I'm not saying the article is misleading, but obviously it is just an article. We do need to bear that in mind. But considering the recent judgment with the Wade decision in the US, and I know we've previously spoken about that on here, this article continues saying information sent to Facebook includes doctor's appointments, prescriptions, medical conditions such as Alzheimer's or pregnancy termination. So it's a big one, I think, for potentially around Pixels, Meta, or the old Facebook, and so on and so forth. But we'll leave it there because I know it might get rather sensitive, but it is a US-based lawsuit based in California against Facebook.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And I think it's, I guess, kind of what we've mentioned already, which is that it's so important to have these lawsuits or cases or claims, whatever you want to call them, whatever they fall under the specific category of, across not just Europe, but as you say, even across the pond, to really sort of drive the conversation, if nothing else, on these issues. Because even if nothing comes out of it, to at least shine a light on that, to at least kick the idea around as you and I are doing here, is incredibly valuable. Because I think we probably... Well, I certainly have sometimes I know you do, a slightly cynical view of these things, and you sort of come to expect that this sort of absurd harvesting of information is happening, but to actually see it exposed is incredibly valuable, and it's incredibly valuable to have people who will take up these cases against the big tech giants accordingly, I think. Just on Pixels, I have been keeping up with the chat, I promise. I'm not just ignoring all your comments, but there's a lot of interaction in there. I think we've covered off a lot of it. There's a couple bits in relation to Google Analytics and Pixels. Steph, I'm just going to pick up the latest one here. Steph's saying, I believe it's the setup of the technology, not the pixel itself, in the same way as if you put Google Analytics on a site and it's on, say, a login page that has name or email address, and you provide GDPR personal data across. I feel like you've tailed off there, but I think I know what you're getting at, which is that ultimately, a lot of the time, part of the problem with this type of kit tracking technology is that it's not fundamentally understood by a lot of the organizations employing it. I don't know whether that's your key point there, Steph, but that's my experience anyway, is that a lot of the time it's not understood how it actually works, what it does, how it collects it. And as a result of that, you can't properly mitigate that, or not mitigate it, that's maybe not the right word, but you can't sort of account for that from a compliance perspective, first of all, because how are you supposed to properly inform users of what's happening and gain their consent if you yourself do not understand it? But sometimes, I mean, I hate to bring this up because I thought we'd put it to bed, but long-time listeners will know that many moons ago, I got into quite a heated argument with a supplier on behalf of one of my customers because they kept arguing that their solution was not caught by Pekka, that it didn't require consent, that what they did was not a cookie. And I kept saying to them, no, I understand that what you do is not a cookie, but what it is device fingerprinting. And that's the same thing. It still reads information from or writes information to a user's device, and therefore it requires consent. And we went back and forth on the issue a number of times. And eventually they said, for some reason, we put the question to them differently. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, yeah, it does need consent. And it was sort of just this exasperation of, well, why have we been running around in circles this whole time? Is it really because we use the word cookie and you didn't want to call it that? Because if that's the key issue, that's, you know, ludicrous. I mean, maybe them from a PR perspective, that's where they're coming from. But again, a lot of it was just that there wasn't necessarily an understanding of what this was or how it worked. And you look under the bonnet and a lot of the time it's not massively complex. It's just that there is sometimes, I guess, kind of what Alan's referring to, tracking pixels devious by design. I'm not sure it's necessarily devious, but I do think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors involved in a lot of this tech, that it's not provided to us explicitly. It's not explained to us explicitly how a lot of this works. And that's kind of one of the core problems. We've always said, haven't we, Dave, that one of our number one things with cookies and all this type of tracking tech isn't necessarily, you know, the extent or the intrusiveness of the tracking taking place. The real thing for us is that you're properly informed about it and that you're able to make a genuine choice. From there on out,
for sure,
I'm not too bothered. I mean, I always say, you know, I'm pretty keen on targeted advertising. I'd rather, if I'm going to be subject to it, I'd rather it be tailored to me. So I will often opt into cookies. But, you know,
For me, it's two bits really. One is absolutely spot on, it's about the transparency. But how much is too much? How much do they need to know in order to serve your targeted ads? And how much is too much in that sense, if you know what I mean? Because if you look at what we've just been talking about with Facebook, surely, well, what is the point in Facebook having that information back to them? What are they going to do about it? That kind of thing. There's some things that you should be saying, well, is that fundamental? Maybe it shouldn't be going anywhere else. Maybe it shouldn't be picked up and tracked. There may well be other indicators that you can find. There may well be other interactions that you have on the website that might suffice for targeted ads and not necessarily go into such granular detail. But like you say, it's all about, from my point, it's all about transparency. It's all about choice, and the choice should be yours. It shouldn't be imposed and it shouldn't be removed. It should be up to you to make that decision.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm just looking at Lars has popped in the chat a screen cap from Ryanair's website where they've got Google Analytics ticked by default. Dearie me. I bet there's some poor DPO or privacy lead tearing the hair out of that because they're either not aware of it or they've been overruled on the matter. Or maybe
and again, we've looked at cookies where, very similar to what Lars is picking up, but where you get presented with so many, it takes an awful long time to switch them off, if you indeed do so. I can remember a conversation with Phil. I think he was on one of the podcasts previously when he said how long it took him to turn them all off because they'd all been switched on. And likewise, I've certainly seen, I don't know if you've come across them, I'll try and dig one out and again take a screenshot of it, where it's kind of consent's turned off but legitimate interest is turned on.
Don't get me started, it's so infuriating. Well, one of those big I can't remember the exact name of the company, I wouldn't want to name them for reasons which will become evident in just a second. But one of the big solutions for cookie management, one of the big consent management platforms, was recently outlawed, wasn't it, in Europe? They said this doesn't work, or at least the mechanism which they had applied across all of their customers' websites, which was, I think, twofold. It's like a cookie wall, so you had to make a selection. And it also had what you're describing there, I think, Dave, which was a lot of pre-ticked legitimate interest stuff and just generally nonsense. I mean, the thing that I often come back to with my customers about cookies is that it's actually not that difficult. Like, really, a lot of it is placed on it, and a lot of the government's messaging we saw in the context of the data reform bill was all the cookie red tape, and it's a nightmare, and some of the tabloids got in on it, and, you know, we need to get rid of it, etc. But it's really not that difficult to get right, you know. And I think probably the key thing is just understanding what's there and how it works in the first place, communicating that and giving people a choice. It can't be that difficult.
But it's funny when you say it's understanding what's there in the first place, because how many times have you been with some of your clients and you're asking them about the cookies on the website and they've got no idea what the website's got on it? Yeah. So it's transparency both ways. The organisation needs to understand and know what's on its website, and then they need to pass that down the line in a transparent and clear and fair way so individuals know what the cookies are there for, and so on and so forth. But it amazes me when some people say to you, well, I don't know what's on the website.
Sure. And I guess part of it does come back to what Steph's saying here, which is the issue is that cookies are a means to an end. You need to determine the purpose. If you don't know what the purpose is, then there's no accountability around that, which, you know, is a very good point. You know, ultimately, this is kind of a lot of the time what we say about these things is that the cookie is just a piece of kit. It's just technology. Like, it is not inherently evil. It is not inherently harvesting your data, you know, to sell off to big corporate, et cetera, and being invasive. It's just a tool, and it depends how you've calibrated it. And if you don't have, as Steph says, a clearly defined purpose, a clearly defined scope for what it is you're trying to do, then you've already sort of lost the battle, I suppose, in that respect.
No, for sure. And let's be fair to cookies. Some cookies are nice cookies, aren't they? We're only talking about the intrusive ones. You've certainly got some cookies that are needed on websites to make the website work, say, like shopping baskets. And that kind of stuff. So you've certainly got some essential cookies. So although we're badgering cookies at the moment, there are some useful ones on there in order to improve user experience. And as I say, such as the shopping basket, that would never retain what you dropped in it if it didn't follow you around the web page.
Well, yeah, but again, like, just to expand on that, I think kind of the issue is that there aren't any. This is what I'm saying. There aren't any good and bad cookies. They're all just cookies. It's all just technology at the end of the day. Like, it's what your intention behind that is, because in theory you can make it do anything you want. So I've mentioned this previously. I work with a customer at the minute who their bread and butter, effectively, or at least one side of their bread and butter, is tracking, is analytics, right? And they do it through this very specific solution that they have that's built on cookies, or has historically been built on cookies. And they've calibrated it in what I think personally, and not just because I work with them, because they've made these decisions before I even started working with them, but they've calibrated it in a way which I think is great. It's really privacy conscious. You know, it really sort of collects the bare minimum. It doesn't do any cross-platform, cross-website tracking. You know, it's limited to very, very specific defined uses which are communicated to people and are proportionate. Fundamentally, they're proportionate uses, and that's my issue, is that I think a lot of the time we can get sort of stuck in this language of saying, oh well, these ones are good, these ones are bad, but ultimately, you know, it's just how you define your scope at the outset. And if you've got that right, then you'll be fine.
The only reason why I defined it as kind of good cookies is because, like you said, the essence of what you're talking about could appear that some cookies aren't used for just purposes of making the website work. So you get these kind of, and then you get these, when you start talking about tracking cookies, you normally get a lot of negative language as opposed to positive language. So these things make the website work, user interface and so on and so forth, and using really positive language. And sometimes you talk about the tracking stuff and it can come across as rather negative, as in the good and the bad, not necessarily looking at the device and the mechanism itself. So in essence, a gun doesn't kill people. It's the person behind the gun that's pulling the trigger that kills people in that kind of sense.
Must you really draw that parallel? God, you are a fire starter at times, aren't you? Go on, finish your point.
So the point calling them good cookies was more about the language that we use when we're talking about them. I actually do get the point that the cookie itself is just a thing. And it's a use of that thing that determines and understanding the use of that thing and how it affects and so on and so forth.
No, for sure, for sure. Lawrence is saying that he'd seen a seen cookies with a retention of 365 years associated with them, which is either a typo or it begs the question of what on earth they're doing with that. That's got to be a typo, surely. It can't be 365 years. I mean, maybe it is, but
either a typo or inputted by a time traveller.
Yes, quite possibly. Quite possibly.
Anyway, we jest.
We do jest indeed. And we do end up talking about this sort of thing quite a lot, but I think it's probably because it's quite so prevalent. One thing I did want to say, actually, just because, again, something Lawrence mentions is would like some software that allows me to set my privacy options so that whenever I go to a website, it checks it in and sets the local website to my preferred settings, etc., which I believe is kind of the approach that the government want in their data reform bill, right? They want it to be browser-led privacy settings as opposed to website-specific. Just on that note, I don't know if anyone, and I promise I'm not on commission, but I don't know if anyone here is an iPhone user, but I've just done the latest iOS update, and it makes a point in your Safari browser now of saying, in the last 7 days, Safari's prevented 114 trackers from profiling you and hidden your IP address from known trackers, which again opens a whole other can of worms which we've explored previously, which is what happens when these tech giants start being privacy conscious. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Are they doing it for the right reasons? Does it matter if they're doing it for the right reasons? But we spoke a lot about the app transparency tracking framework a while ago, which is all to do with the fact that previously anyone with an app could stick tracking technology on it. And, you know, there's very sort of little to stop you doing that. You didn't need consent. And now Apple sort of enforced that for you. But really, if you're being a bit cynical, it's sort of more a case of now they hold both the key and the lock. So, you know,
yeah, but I think
they hold all the cards. Yeah. But ultimately, you'd think that sort of any advancement in privacy is positive in that respect. Sorry, I cut across you, Dave.
Well, it is, but I think they're doing, and I know we discussed this before, so this is probably just recycling previous conversations, but it's what they're badging as privacy is just their protection of their own commerciality, because they're trying to stop people targeting you unless you use their platform. So is it really being privacy sensitive, or is it just protecting the dollars that they're making?
Yeah. Steph reckons that server-side tagging will make things less transparent to users. Browsers banning third-party cookies have shifted or will hide the issue, and then ask whatever happened to do not track initiatives. Because you're right, Steph, those do all still... There are still a lot of those knocking about. But again, part of the problem with that is that then you're relying on the user to make those choices, and we're not all clued up on what this all means. But unfortunately, some of us may suffer the consequences of that. And this is where I do find it slightly problematic when we talk about browser-led settings, etc. If you're putting the onus on the user, I'm not massively comfortable with that idea. Like, it kind of counteracts my previous point about making sure people are informed, giving them a genuine choice. But it shouldn't necessarily be, and listen, I'm putting words in your mouth and that's not entirely fair, but it shouldn't be on the user to go and, you know, proactively sort this out for themselves. They shouldn't have to necessarily go through that to go and protect themselves effectively. I mean, that's slightly sort of inflammatory language, but that's kind of the idea.
It's kind of simplifying it. If you're putting it on the user to, you either opt them out and the user opts in, or you opt them in and the user opts out.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So there's going to be kind of a bit of a binary starting point. You're either in or you're out in that kind of sense. And you can imagine that if it's down to the user, unless the privacy conscious, then they'll be saying, well, everybody's in unless you tell us otherwise, because otherwise the whole thing will fall apart potentially if everybody's out unless they go, yes, okay. Because how many people will actually say that from... When we look at other things, you look at the national data opt-in for donor cards and things, and they move that to the fact that everybody's opted in unless you opt out, and suddenly the number of organs for donations going up through the roof, that kind of thing. Mm. I guess it depends if they are going to do that, what's the starting point with it, because otherwise you may find people are opted in, and then those that don't understand those are a bit scared of technology and stuff will suddenly find that their data has been harvested against the will, but not quite sure how to stop it because of, fear of tech.
Quite. Yeah, Lawrence has shared a screen cap from that cookie. 3,650 days. Yeah, that is an awfully long time. That's a different one. Sorry.
The Daily
Excuse
Mail,
me.
Yeah.
Excuse me, yeah, so 10 years. I mean, why on earth? Because that's the thing, right? Like, why on earth would you even want that as an organisation? What possible value can you derive? I mean, I don't know. I'm not a marketing guy, but I struggle to understand the value that you could derive from having data that reaches that far back for something that is so theoretically inane as, you know, whether someone visited, well, it's the Daily Mail website, if someone visited a particular article 10 years ago. Like, I just don't. To me, this is kind of part of the problem with a lot of things. Well, it's not proportionate, but also you're just collecting it for the sake of collecting it, and you're keeping it for the sake of collecting it, and you're just hoarding masses of data, and ultimately that's just, yeah, I really don't understand the purpose behind it. But anyway, we've ended up filling a lot of time talking about this. It's a subject which clearly we're quite passionate about, and we talk about a lot. Maybe we need to schedule a standalone session on cookies, but we've done that a few times. Maybe we could do another one. Who knows? Who knows? Steph saying apologies, but this is one area where the ICO have not been proactive. Why does no one complain? The ICO complaint page takes 8 to 10 steps. Is the lack of complaints due to the poor UX of cookie complaints? Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I think Phil's spoken on this feed before about just how difficult it is to do anything on the ICO website, in his opinion. But yeah, the complaints process is not easy. So I've put in a number of complaints about other things in the past, and as you do. And yeah, it's terrible. The complaints process is awful. It's really difficult to use. And I've had it in cases where I've gone through the entire thing and then it's crashed on me. So I've had to resubmit the whole thing and then it's crashed again. So it's taken me sort of three times as long as it should have done to submit what is arguably quite a simple complaint. So yeah, I do think you're right from that perspective, Steph. But I don't know. The weird thing, again, cookies, we've spoken about this before. Surely cookies is a low-hanging fruit for the ICO. It's so easy to demonstrate that organisations are not compliant.
I would agree. So, I'm not sure why they're not chasing it, to be honest.
Because that's one of the things that we've often said about the direct marketing stuff. It's so blatantly obvious to prove that an organisation is in contradicting statute. Surely cookies fall into the same basket. So what's the rationale behind not pursuing it more? Don't know. Who knows? Lars says, but the ICO is also clear that cookies is currently not one of their enforcing priorities. But again, like, I wonder why that is. Who knows? We have just hit our allocated time, Dave. I'm aware of that. I'm happy to stick around a little bit longer if there's anything, because there are things that you've put in our notes that we've not touched on. One of the things is that, to be honest with you, I assume this had been said while I was away, because I think we're all now aware of this, which is the story about a person who got, I think, had a little bit too much to drink and lost a USB stick containing data on the residents of an entire city. I'm sure we've all seen this.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite a funny one, kind of going around, and it's just an interesting one because it's one that you could easily add into. And the reason why I put out this is I'm sure we all understand, and we could probably all quite easily answer the question. But you could withhold some of the detail and then use this kind of thing as a quite easily within training materials within organisations. So you could pose this kind of thing: what's happened? Would that be a reportable breach, or would that not be a reportable breach or notifiable breach to the ICO? That kind of thing. And then as you kind of go through it, and then you're kind of looking at this and say, okay, well, he's lost this. Yeah, okay, you could go down this line of it's a reportable breach, but would your decision change if that stick was encrypted? And you know what I mean? It just allows you to start bringing training to life. So you're talking about a real life situation and allows you to kind of play around with the facts a little bit until you start bringing all of the facts out and just have great discussion points around bits and pieces. So the stick was encrypted. It was later found, I think it was about a couple of hours later, by the local police and returned. So does that affect any of your opinions about whether it's a notifiable breach? Do you need to tell the regulator? Do you need to tell the data subjects? That kind of thing. If they're obviously governed by the GDPR, I think it's lost an entire city load of information, but I don't think it was possibly based in the UK either. But it's just great talking points. It's great things for training materials to bring the whole lot to life. And that's kind of why I put it. I'm sure everybody can work their way through some of those questions. But when we're trying to engage with our teams, it's certainly a useful example to really kind of pitch a load of training around.
No, that is a good point. That is a good point, because all too often I do find myself sort of working through some training, sort of going, oh God, I could do with a nice example to illustrate this. So it is worth sometimes just keeping an eye on things and ferreting them away when they come up.
For sure. Yeah. The other one quickly was the recent case with Smith versus TalkTalk, for anybody that's following some of the case law. And basically, there's not a great deal to this case. It's quite interesting to read through it, but in essence, it just affirms the decision in Warren versus DSG. So the case was struck out. It was a claim for misuse of private information. So the regular kind of the hackers access the system with TalkTalk. Some of the information was lost or misused and that kind of stuff, and the claim came against TalkTalk for misuse of their private information, and the justice that was hearing the case reaffirmed that it's the hacker's conduct that amounts to misuse and not the hacked company in that sense. So just reaffirms the case, and I just thought it's useful sometimes just to pick up on that. And it's also further interesting to identify in there that that would still be the case even if a company's security failure facilitates the fraud that is committed by third parties in that sense. So you need to focus on whether the alleged conduct amounts to misuse of private information. And then that got me thinking, and I'm no way a lawyer in that sense for challenging things, but could it be argued then that there's a fiduciary duty to appropriate security measures, obviously pursuant to Article 32, and that a security breach is a breach of that fiduciary duty instead of chasing misuse of personal information? I don't know. Be one for anybody who's got a bit more brains and a bit more skill in this area than me, but it's an interesting concept at least.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And I'd followed, I'll be honest, I hadn't seen this, but I had followed the rationale of Warren. And so that's interesting to see that confirmed. Dave, do you have a link to that you can pop in the chat by any chance?
Yes, it's from good friends I have at DSCB. So I'll just pick that up and drop it for you.
Lovely stuff. Well, on that note, I think we can probably bring this to a close, since I've got to jump for another meeting, I'm afraid, and we have to record the intro to this as we always do after the session. So on that note, Dave, I will thank you very much for your time and your insights this afternoon. Plenty of good stuff in there. I'd also like to thank you all listeners for joining us once again on this feed. We very much enjoy doing these episodes, so thank you kindly for your time, and thank you for all your contributions to those populating the chats. It's very much appreciated. Sorry I didn't get to quite as much of it as I would normally do this week, but there was a lot going on. We will be back again next week, I do believe, with our colleagues at 3C Consulting, and we're going to be talking about data accuracy and maximizing the value of your data. So this one is specifically targeted at the housing sector, but there's plenty of other things that will be in there for those who aren't in housing, which should be of interest to you. Again, making the most out of your data sets should be really interesting. The chaps from 3C have got a slightly different perspective to us, so it'd be really good to kick those things around. And then the week after that, as per usual, GDPR Radio, Dave and I will be back on this same forum. So if there's anything that we've missed today, that we've not picked up, anything that you'd like to talk about a little bit more, then just get in touch with us. But for now, we shall leave it at that. So thank you all for your time. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll catch up with you very soon.
Thank you very much. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take care now. Thank you.